I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Fannie Lou Hamer was the youngest of 20 children born into a Mississippi sharecropper's family in 1917, the granddaughter of enslaved Black people. She went to work in the fields when she was six and had to quit school when she was in sixth grade to help support the family. In fact, it wasn't until 1962 that she understood that she had the right to vote after attending a meeting of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Fannie Lou Hamer spent the rest of her life as a champion for civil rights, with a message shaped by her experience of poverty and the violence of Jim Crow. She was fearless and nearly died having been brutally beaten in a Mississippi jail. She was also a riveting speaker. Her speech at the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City in 1964 is the only one that is remembered today, and we'll play a clip later on in the show. We asked Keisha Blaine to tell us more about Fannie Lou Hamer. Her new book is Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. She's Associate Professor of History at the University of Pittsburgh, and she is President of the African American Intellectual History Society. Keisha Blaine, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. You begin the very first sentence of this book writing that you did not know anything about Fannie Lou Hamer until you were a senior in college. This was 2008. I'm sure a lot of our audience is in the same boat. Why this extraordinary woman is so little known?
Well, I think generally when we look at the civil rights movement, the narratives that tend to dominate the mainstream are those that center the political work of Black men. And so there's so many, books and articles about someone like Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., John Lewis, and so many others. And then even when we do focus on women in the civil rights movement, we tend to focus on a handful of women. And so when I teach courses on the civil rights movement and I ask my students, who are the women leaders of the movement? Immediately, they would answer Rosa Parks. Someone might say Coretta Scott King. Another person might mention Angela Davis. But what's clear is that we tend to overlook, I think, just an array of figures. And Fannie Lou Hamer is one of those individuals who I think has been largely left out of the narrative, because she's so different than many of the folks who we tend to focus on.
Well, she has an extraordinary life. I mean, in many ways described as, I'm going to use quotations here on the radio, you know, this was an ordinary person. So she wasn't, you know, she was not a college graduate, clearly not a man, and sort of worked really at that grassroots level.
Exactly. She was not a member of the Black middle class and elite, and she did not have a lot of experience, too. And, you know, as I explained in the book, she came to the civil rights movement fairly later in life, at the age of 44. Many of the people she worked with had been active in the movement, but they were much younger, or other people had been really, I think, involved in the at least at the national level, you know, on a national stage a bit longer. So she lacked a lot of experience in the political arena. And she did not have much formal education. As I explained, she received a sixth grade education. She was a sharecropper, for much of her life in Mississippi. And all of these things, I think, set her apart. What is interesting is, even though they all of these traits tended to marginalize her, at the same time, all of these traits made her, I think, all the more impactful as a leader, because she understood what people were going through at the time.
How would you say Mississippi, where she grew up and spent so much of her life, how would you say Mississippi shaped then her views on race, on poverty, on America?
Mississippi was absolutely fundamental to Fannie Lou Hamer's political activism, certainly. And I think so many people, when we talk about Mississippi in the 1950s, immediately many people will think about the Emmett Till case of 1955, just a brutal, painful incident where this young man, this boy, lost his life and was lynched in Mississippi. This is the context of which Hamer grew up. This is the context in which she organized. She knew that this was a place where it was dangerous to speak out about racial injustice. This was a place where you could lose your life simply for demanding better for yourself. And so it definitely shaped her ideas. It emboldened her. I think it, in many ways, made her all the more fearless, because she understood that, you know, all the work that she did, that it was a matter of life and death. She could not play around. It was about fighting for Black liberation and making sure that people had a better tomorrow. I think it was always this forward-looking vision that she maintained.
You know, she was the youngest of 20 children, and you write a bit about her parents, her mother in particular. In fact, you say that she was her mother's favorite, but you also described her mother's sort of small acts of resistance and defying the rules. How much do you think that shaped some of the activism of Fannie Lou Hamer?
I think her mother was so influential. In fact, one of the things that I write about in the book is how her mother would really try to bolster Hamer's self-esteem. She would tell her that she was beautiful. She would tell her to value her Blackness, to not look upon herself, in shame, but to really be proud. And so her mother instilled in her race pride, certainly. And also, her mother instilled with her the importance of standing up for yourself. One of the things that I discuss in the book is how her mother would carry a gun. I mean, she would carry one hidden, you know, as she was working on the fields. And that's a very dangerous thing to do in Mississippi. It's certainly a dangerous thing to do in any context. But in this particular moment, you have to imagine how bold a Black woman has to be to carry a weapon. But she did so because she wanted to be well-equipped to protect herself. This was a message about armed self-defense, which, of course, we understand, several years later, even more so through the context of the Black Power movement.
Well, you describe, and she describes what it was like to be part of a sharecropper's family. She began working in the fields when she was a tiny little girl. She was just 6 years old. And describing the kind of level of literally debt and dependency. It was a system to keep Black people down. Can you describe what their life was like?
Well, with the end of slavery in 1865, the institution, really the practice of sharecropping, emerged. And this was a practice that ultimately set out to keep Black people in the same situation. Of course, slavery was over, but now there was a situation where Black people were working on the plantations, oftentimes the same plantations, where their family members had previously been working under the institution of slavery. And with the sharecropping system, one did not own the land on which they toiled, did not even own the tools that they used, would have to borrow, would have to pay fees, would only receive a share of the crops. And so this was meant to keep Black people in a system of debt, certainly, and dependency. And Hamer started, she was born into a sharecropping family, but in earnest started working as a sharecropper at the age of six when she was lured into it by the white landowner.
She describes being hungry, cold. She describes her mother wrapping her feet and her siblings' feet in rags so that they could work the fields when it was bitter cold.
Yes, very brutal conditions. She spoke a lot about poverty and hunger, so many nights that she would go to sleep hungry, and so many times where her family worried about how they would make ends meet. I mean, this was the reality for Hamer. And in so many ways, I think these experiences stayed with her throughout the rest of her life. And she certainly struggled to make ends meet throughout, even in her adult years. But I think those early memories really stayed with her and propelled her activism because, as I mentioned, she could relate. She understood the pain that people were going through, and she wanted to make a meaningful difference.
She goes to a church meeting, and it was organized by SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. This was really a turning point in her life. And as you write, I said in my introduction, she didn't realize until 1962 that she actually had the right to vote. What was this meeting about?
So this was a meeting held at a local church. And really the purpose of the meeting was to galvanize, local residents. It was to let them know, certainly, about their rights as citizens of the United States, but also to encourage them, to work with them, to help them register to vote. One of the things that I emphasize in the book is that only a small percentage, an estimated 5% of Black people in Mississippi at the time were registered to vote. And that is shocking, so shocking, because it meant that you had hundreds of thousands of people in a state whose voices were silenced, whose ideas were not being heard because they could not participate in the political process. And so this meeting was one of revelation, instructing people, but also giving them the tools necessary to make sure that they could register to vote.
And she literally did not understand at that time or until that time that she had the right to vote.
That's what Hamer says, you know, and it's so difficult, I think, when we even reflect on it in this, in today's context, it just seems unheard of. But she emphasized in her speeches that she would emphasize the story to say this is really it's important for us to understand the lengths to which white supremacists would go to make sure that Black people did not participate in the political process. It meant making sure that they did not have access to quality education and also even access to information. And in this context, Hamer said that it was surprising when she sat in that meeting and heard about the way that she could make a difference, the way that she could vote out of office people who were not operating in the best interests of Black people and other marginalized groups in Mississippi. It was certainly a turning point for her.
We're almost having a break here. Do we know about her 19 siblings? Were they politically active?
No, there's very little that I was able to find about her siblings. I certainly was able to find recollections of growing up in the household. What is clear is that Hamer is definitely the most well-known and also the most politically active in the family from what I have been able to find in the research.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Keisha Blaine about her new book, it's titled Until I Am Free, subtitled Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. This is an extraordinary woman, and we're going to play some clips from some of her speeches and some of her interviews. And we want to hear from you. Any questions or comments, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more after the life, the message, the times of Fannie Lou Hamer. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Just a quick recap, especially if you're just joining us. Fannie Lou Hamer was a trailblazing Black activist for voting rights, for economic rights, and women's empowerment. I'm talking today with historian Keisha Blaine about Hamer's path to activism and why her life and work is so relevant to today. Blaine's new book is titled Until I Am Free. Let me just ask you a bit about her marriage to a guy named Perry Pap Hamer. She said she loved all 225 pounds of him. I really like that. What do we know about this marriage?
It's really remarkable when you think about it, because the two, it's just, they loved each other so dearly. One of the things that stood out to me in doing the research was how much they expressed affection and support for each other. Pap Hamer supported Fannie in her political activism. He helped her in so many different contexts. He certainly was not as visible in the movement. Fannie Lou Hamer was always the one that people focused on, but he stood with her, he supported her work, and he made sure that that she constantly felt a sense of love. They would spend time together. There's one example where Hamer reflected on how they would go together and dance in local dance halls, which I enjoyed encountering in the process of doing research. And so that was, I think, just a reflection of the love between them.
She was brutally beaten. This was after doing some activism work to get people registered to vote. And I do want to play a clip. This is actually Fannie Lou Hamer. She's testifying before the Credentials Committee at the Democratic Convention. This is Atlantic City, 1964. And she's there for the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. She describes her arrest. It happens in Winona, Mississippi, with other civil rights activists returning from a voter registration training. And she's taken to a county jail where Black prisoners are forced by the police to beat her. It's about a minute and a half. We had to clean it up a little bit just because it was a little bit muddy, but I do want to make sure that our listeners hear her describing what happened.
After the first Negro had beat until he was exhausted, the state highway patrolman ordered the second Negro to take the blackjack. The second Negro began to beat, and I began to work my feet. And the state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro had beat to sit on my feet, to keep me from working my feet. I began to scream, and one white man got up and began to beat me in my head and tell me to hush. One white man, my dress had worked up high. He walked over and pulled my dress. I pulled my dress down, and he pulled my dress back up. I was in jail when Medgar Evers was murdered. All of this is on account of we want to register to become first-class citizens. And if the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hook, because our lives be threatened daily, because we want to live as decent human beings in America? Thank you.
And again, Fannie Lou Hamer addressing the Democratic National Convention, Atlantic City, 1964. Keisha Blaine, first of all, she was severely beaten, as she describes, and really disabled as a result of this beating.
Yes,
it's so heartbreaking to hear that, but yes,
it
please.
Is. Every time I hear the clip of that speech, I get so emotional because I think about all that she endured and how much courage she needed to display before the world. I mean, this was a televised speech, and this was at the Democratic National Convention, and it's important for people to understand that the beating, which Hamer described in this clip, took place the year before. This was a situation where she was with a group of activists. They had been traveling from a workshop in South Carolina. And she was arrested. She was taken to a jailhouse. And as she talked about, just endured just a painful experience. And it left her with kidney damage, a blood clot in her eye, and it worsened a physical limp from her childhood that she would carry for the rest of her life.
There's so much sadism there. And I think one that really struck me was the police didn't beat her. The police got the other black prisoners to beat her.
Well, she was beaten really, I think, several times in this period. And so the first attack took place at the arrest at the restaurant. She was, police officers started kicking her in that context. And then when she went to the jailhouse, as you pointed out, they instructed prisoners to unleash a brutal beating on Hamer and not just Hamer, certainly other activists who were with her. It changed her. I think it was definitely a moment where she endured really trauma, but even more so, I think for her, it was about how do you address state-sanctioned violence? How do you ensure that this stops? And so as difficult as it was, she decided that she would tell her story.
There's a point where she talks about her dress being up and being down. And she later says in her life that she was sexually assaulted during this violent incident.
Yes. Hamer did not immediately talk about the sexual nature of the beating when she first discussed it publicly. Certainly, she addressed it privately, but in a public context, she was not immediately ready, I think, to reveal all that she had experienced. But when she was ready, she finally opened up. And for her, it was important for people to know what activists were enduring, what Black women were enduring, all of this on account of trying to register people to vote, right? She did not commit any crime. She was helping people. She was trying to ensure that Black people would have access to the vote, something that had been granted in theory by the Constitution. And yet, this is what she had to endure because of it.
I mean, she refused to be silent. It is a kind of a Me Too event, right?
It is. And I thought a lot about Me Too as I was writing the book, and just the courage of so many over the last year in particular, of those who boldly spoke out about acts of sexual harassment and abuse. It's very difficult to do that. And I think Hamer provided a model, an example of how to push past the fear and even the feelings of shame that one can feel and speak boldly about the experience so that others would know, but more so so that the circumstances would change.
And just to add, another piece of this part of her life story, she was sterilized, sort of unbeknownst to her. No one asked her, no white doctor asked her if she wanted to be sterilized. She went in for a procedure and came out sterilized. What happened and what was her response to that?
So this is a year before Hamer joined the civil rights movement in 1961. She had been hospitalized and had gone to remove a small uterine tumor. This was a non-cancerous tumor. Hamer did not know that the doctor, the white doctor who performed the procedure, made the decision to remove her uterus. That in and of itself is just painful and traumatic. But to add insult to injury, she found out about it through gossip, because the doctor was related to someone on the plantation where Hamer worked. So through the Whisper Network, she learned what had taken place. She was, of course, devastated and confronted the doctor, who did not provide an explanation or response. And as Hamer pointed out, he didn't have to, because this was the Jim Crow South. And this was really, I think, a moment where it was clear how state sanctioned violence functions, right? In this case, in the hands of a white doctor who took it upon himself to sterilize Hamer. And this was an experience that was not unique to Hamer. So many Black women, so many poor women in the South particularly, but even in other parts of the nation during this period, had these painful experiences. So this was something that also transformed Hamer's life. And similar to the experience in Winona, she spoke about it. She just confronted it.
And it seemed that these just vicious events that happened to her made her more determined than ever to continue with her work.
Yes. And here's where I would credit her faith above all else. I think Hamer saw herself as someone who was ultimately doing what God wanted her to do. She believed that this was her divine calling. to be an activist, to advocate for those who are in need. That was a mission from on high. And so because of that particular perspective, she just kept pushing and pushing and pushing, even though she endured so many roadblocks along the way.
And Luke 4:18, I'm not a biblical scholar, but Luke 4:18, that was a passage that meant a lot to her.
Yes, and I think this is certainly a verse that, Christians will recognize, but, you know, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. And in this context, the verse is referring to Jesus, right? And in Hamer's conception, it was so relevant to her own story. It was her somewhat drawing connection, right, to Jesus and saying in a similar way, she is going to preach the gospel. And what's the gospel for Hamer? The gospel of liberation. She's going to set people free from racism and white supremacy. And so I think her life shows how much the religious aspects certainly bolstered her political activism.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Keisha Blaine. We're talking about her new book. It's titled Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. And again, you can join us. Any questions or comments, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me ask you about the title, Until I Am Free. This is something that she said, Keisha Blaine, a lot. What did she mean by that?
So many times when she would speak, and oftentimes she would speak before audiences, diverse audiences, she would say in various iterations, but she would say something like, you know, whether you are white or black, you are not free until I am free. And this was her way of connecting to her audiences and letting people know that we are all in this together, despite the differences of, you know, we may have different differences in our economic status or race, ethnicity, ability, sexuality, and so on. We are all connected, and we're connected through humanity. So this was a phrase that I think encapsulates her political vision, one of unity and one of forcing us to recognize that we cannot truly be liberated if anyone around us, if anyone in the nation is somehow in captive.
She goes on to say, because no man is an island to himself until I am free in Mississippi. You are not free in Washington. You are not free in New York, just to underscore what you said.
Exactly. And so this was a way to also remind people that it wasn't simply a Southern story. I think there are so many people who would, especially in the context in which Hamer lived, would be thinking, okay, you know, yes, the Jim Crow South, there are challenges there. She was saying what Black people are experiencing in the Jim Crow South is very much connected to what people are experiencing all over the nation and all over the world. As I explained, she came to a place where she started to link the challenges of African Americans to other people of color globally.
Well, and in her views of liberation, I underscored this, and this is where she's talking about white women, and I'll just quote her, and she says, but you know, sometimes I really feel more sorrier for the white woman than I feel for ourselves, because she's been caught up in this thing, caught up feeling very special, and folks, I'm going to put it on the line, because my job is not to make people feel comfortable. You've been caught up in this thing because, you know, you worked my grandmother, and after that, you worked my mother, and finally, you got a hold of me. Keisha Blaine, can you speak to that?
Yes. This was Hamer, really just raw Hamer, speaking truth to power, calling out in this instance, calling out white women and white liberal feminists too, saying that you cannot simply talk about your experiences, you know, as a woman, you can't talk about sexism without grappling with racism, because in fact, you have benefited from white supremacy, and you have to acknowledge that privilege. And this was her way of just laying it all on the table and saying, you've lived in this bubble, you know, for all this time, and now you need to open up your eyes to understand what other people are enduring in this country, and specifically what Black women are facing in this country.
Let me play an interview. This is Fannie Lou Hamer in 1968 in the documentary The Heritage of Slavery by George Foster. And this is from an interview, part of this documentary.
So many of our ancestors was killed because we have never accepted slavery. We had to live on it, but we've never wanted it. So we know that this flag is drenched with our blood. So what the young people are saying now, give us a chance to be young men, respected as a man. As we know, this country was built on the black backs of black people across this country. And if we don't have it, you ain't gonna have it either, because we gonna tear it up. That's what they're saying. And people ought to understand that. I don't see why they don't understand that. They know what they've done to us.
And we have about a minute before our second break here, Keisha Blaine. That could be said today.
Absolutely. I think there's so many connections. And in fact, one of the things I talk about in the book, you know, is the Black Lives Matter movement. You see so many resonances when you listen to how Hamer talks about politics and change in the context of the Jim Crow South, but certainly it's applicable to this current moment.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, talking with Keisha Blaine about her new book. It's titled Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. And our guest is Associate Professor of History at the University of Pittsburgh, also President of the African American Intellectual History Society. And we're talking about the life, the activism, the message of Fannie Lou Hamer, and how it has resonance today. You've had a chance to hear some of her words in her own voice. What do you think? Give us an email, or send us an email, I should say, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me play one more clip. This is Fannie Lou Hamer discussing the words, how the words of the national anthem can feel meaningless to Black Americans. This audio is from the documentary Fannie Lou Hamer's America by Joy Elaine Davenport. It's about a minute.
My soul is tired of seeing people suffer. I'm very tired of every time I pick up a book or every time I pick up a newspaper talking about somebody that's been shot, somebody that's been killed. This country is coming apart at the seams, and it's up to us to make this a better country. Because to be perfectly honest, it's hard for me to stand up and sing the national anthem. I stand up and I work my mouth, but I don't always come through with the verses. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hail? Because actually the land of the free and the home of the brave have meant the land of the tree and the home of the grave for so many of us.
Keisha Blaine, she's referring to lynchings, correct?
Correct. Wow.
And, yeah, and another one, right?
Yeah, and, yes. I think... And one of the reasons why, you know, I wrote the book was really my attempt to encourage people to listen to Hamer, to go back to her words. I mean, it's just when you hear Hamer speak, I remember when I first heard this particular speech, I thought immediately about Colin Kaepernick, right? I thought about all of these conversations we've had over the last years about whether one should stand or kneel, you know, when the national anthem is played. And this particular topic has divided the nation too. People have, you know, people have strong opinions. It brought everything to the surface for me, because I think we see so many parallels, right? Hamer wanted people to understand that, you know, it's not that she wasn't proud, you know, of being an American, but what she's saying is, listen, I don't have access to all the benefits of American citizenship. You know, for Black people in this country, for so many marginalized groups, it's simply, you know, an experience that does not align to this, you know, to the idea of American democracy, to the principles of liberty and justice for all. And so she brought all of these concerns to the fore. And I think that that speech is just another example of her power and the way that she used words so skillfully to capture everyone listening.
I was reading perhaps in your book, Keisha, about the numbers of lynchings between 1882 and 1968, almost 4,000 lynchings in this country, most of them of African Americans. But underscoring, just 1968 was the last lynching in this country.
And I should say several things. One, documented, right? The distinction between what's right. documented and not documented, because so much of the violence that has taken place, we simply don't even know the details, but they took place nonetheless. And the other thing too, and this in and of itself, I think, is still, you know, a topic for discussion, is that, you know, yes, according to the historical record, that was supposedly the last lynching. But not so much, because I think anyone who has paid attention to just the violence that Black and brown people have endured in this country, they recognize that it's an ongoing problem, right? I mean, we sort of don't use the language of lynching today the way that activists used it in the 50s and 60s, but that's not to suggest that it's not taking place.
Right. Let me ask you about if she thought of herself as a feminist, how she viewed feminism. It's interesting. She opposed both birth control and abortion, which she described as reproductive injustice. Help us mm-hmm. understand that part of her life.
Well, Fannie Lou Hamer simply rejected the classification, the term feminist. And I think it's important to understand the context. It's important to understand how much she as a Black woman, and I think so many other people agreed with her at the time, she didn't see her interests as part, you know, of the women's liberation movement. She did not see Black women being a focal point, and they were not. I mean, that's the reality. So many white feminists, you know, at the time, and of course their resonances to the present, would talk about, you know, patriarchy, will talk about sexism, but not want to grapple as deeply with racism and not want to talk about white supremacy. So for those reasons, Hamer did not see herself as connected to the movement. At the same time, as I explained in the book, though she rejected the label, she ended up being such an influence for the movement because of everything that she did. And she spoke out boldly, you know, about forced sterilizations, for example. She supported women's, you know, empowerment. She wanted, you know, to ensure that women would run for office. And she herself ran for office several times. So though she rejected the label, she ended up contributing, as I argue, to, you know, to the feminist movement broadly. And she constantly tried to push activists to be mindful of the overlapping systems of oppression, right? And so this is the language today that we use, you know, from Kimberly Crenshaw, of intersectionality.
She was a member of SNCC. How did she view the NAACP and its leadership?
She was very critical of the NAACP, and part of her critique came from, I think, her own personal experience. So for example, as I explained in the book, one of the leaders of the NAACP, Roy Wilkins, at the 1964 Democratic National Convention, described Hamer as an ignorant woman.
Ouch.
Yeah, and that was a painful moment, I think, for her. But it spoke to, I think, the class divides, the class dimensions of the movement. You know, people came from different backgrounds, and some people felt that they were better representatives of the race because of their education and social class. And so she was critical of the NAACP. And to be clear, you know, as I explain in the book, you know, this is not, you know, the NAACP is in and of itself is a diverse organization, and lots of people are involved from different backgrounds. But I think Hamer pointed to what she saw as moments of sort of elitism, you know, and coming up in the kinds of encounters that she had with various individuals.
Here's a tweet from Janet who says, some other white people don't want to admit slavery's effects. To do so would mean a call for reparations, which are long overdue. Did Fannie Lou Hamer talk about reparations at all? And how do you see that fitting into her life and sort of where we are today?
I think she did, and I think it's important to understand. I think when we talk about reparations, oftentimes the first thought we have is, you know, someone necessarily writing a check. And I think reparations is far more expansive, and really thinking about all of the ways that we can provide some kind of redress, you know, for years, I mean, for decades of injustice and exclusion. And Hamer certainly spoke about the importance of not only on the local level, but on a national level of public officials providing resources for those in need. But, you know, she was also committed to an idea of economic self-sufficiency, right? And so she was, on the one hand, making demands, you know, of the state to provide resources, and also thinking through what she could do on the local level.
You write that you were a first-gen college student. You were at a largely white university and discovered Fannie Lou Hamer. What did she, how did she help you with yourself and finding your place, both in that university community, but even beyond and outside?
Well, I was so inspired and remain inspired by Fannie Lou Hamer's boldness. I think it's so difficult when you're in a space and you feel so out of place. And I've carried that feeling throughout so many aspects of my life, because I'm not always, but often in rooms you know, where I just stand out for all kinds of reasons. And I think reading about Hamer and encountering her life and her activism provided for me a model of how one can still contribute, even when you feel out of place, even when you feel like you don't have all of the resources that you imagine you might need, you still come up with a way to make a difference, no matter how small. And I think that's the message that I was able to learn, you know, through her life. It empowered me and it pushed me to just try to make a difference, no matter how small.
I mean, she really was fearless. I mean, we throw that word around, but I think when you look at the totality of her life, where she came from, what she had to endure, how she prevailed, I mean, fearless really describes Fannie Lou Hamer.
I think so. You know, one of the reasons why I talk so much about the violence that Black people endured in Mississippi in Hamer's lifetime is because I want readers to recognize how dangerous it was for Fannie Lou Hamer to do half of what she was doing. And she was doing it all. I mean, she was doing it so publicly. There were threats on her life, that, you know, there were assassination attempts. I mean, people shot up, you know, at, you know, homes that where she where, you know, where they knew that she would be. And so this was not some sort of, you know, lighthearted, I'm going around talking about liberation and everything is fine. No, this was, you know, an environment where in an instant, right, she could lose her life. She saw what happened to other civil rights leaders. You know, she saw what happened to people who spoke out. And yet she just kept going and going and going.
Do we know what life is like? And she grew up in a place called Ruleville, interesting name, Ruleville, Mississippi. What life is like in her hometown today?
So many challenges persist in Ruleville, Mississippi today. In fact, one of the I think the most memorable aspects for me of doing the research for the book was having an opportunity to talk to Hamer's daughter. You know, she, as I explained in the book, she adopted two young girls, you know, and I was able to talk to her family, and they point out how so much remains the same. Wow. When we think about poverty and hunger, when we think about even racial violence. And that to me, that certainly was difficult for me to process. But again, that's why this story is so important, because we still have so much work to do. And Hamer is no longer with us in the flesh, but her words remain, and her vision, I think, remains salient. And I just hope that people find inspiration in her story.
Be interesting. I mean, it's impossible to know what she would be thinking and doing today, but I'm sure, Keisha Blaine, you've thought about that. How would she view where we are racially, class-wise, as a country?
I think she would be frustrated. You know, she was frustrated in the 60s, you know, looking at where Black people were, looking at where the nation was, and saying, you know, why is it that folks are still fighting to have access to the vote when, you know, the Reconstruction amendments, you know, guaranteed this? And I imagine that today she would just be appalled. She would say, why are we even still talking about voter suppression? Like, that doesn't make any sense, right? I mean, this is 2021. And of course, we, Hamer, you know, as so many others celebrated in 65, the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And yet here we are still seeing all of these efforts to limit access to the vote. So I think she'd be frustrated, but she would tell people, okay, you're frustrated too, then get up, stand up, let's do something, let's change the system, let's just keep fighting, because she always maintained hope that change was possible.
She loved this song, This Little Light of Mine. We're going to close the show with her singing some of this song. Why did this song have such meaning for her?
Well, certainly it was a song that she sang often in her childhood. So I think it certainly connected. It made her feel just a closeness to her family and her community. But also it was a song that I think reminded her of her role. She saw herself as bringing light to darkness, to the darkness of racism and white supremacy. She saw herself as being that beacon of light. And so singing that song was a reminder to her about her calling, and also a way to empower others to join the effort to be a light also.
And she died March 14th, 1977. What did she die of?
Well, Hamer had just a number of medical issues. She had diabetes. She had breast cancer. You know, as I explained in the book, she was selfless, and that meant she didn't really take care of herself much. She didn't rest much. And that's unfortunate. You know, it's certainly a cautionary tale. It just as a reminder that as much as we're fighting for liberation, we also have to be mindful of how we care for ourselves so that we could continue the work for as long as possible.
Do you miss her? Do you miss writing about her?
I do. I think what was great about writing the book is that I got to know her a lot more. And so that's just a special feeling of feeling a closeness to someone that you have not met, but you've just been transformed by their words. So that is certainly a beautiful experience, and I'm grateful for that.
Well, thank you for writing the book. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times, Keisha Blaine.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And again, the book is titled Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. Keisha Blaine, Associate Professor of History at the University of Pittsburgh. She's also President of the African American Intellectual History Society. Go to WHYY.org and you can look for Radio Times under Programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. This is Fannie Lou Hamer, This Little Light of Mine.
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Oh, this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light.